he said, you know, he had gotten the recording equipment. He was like, if you would do a show, what would you do a show about? And, you know, I said horror, because that's what we already always talk about. So I guess that's why we're doing it. And I like to explore different things. Like, I've learned so much doing the show, and I like to think that people who listen learn a little bit or hear about movies and they go out and see those movies. Because I'm a huge, like, advocate for the genre, and I just want to encourage people to watch it.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are The Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
It doesn't seem like it should be that hard to tell a true story. What a pure impulse to have come across an incredible story. Maybe it's your own story that demands to be told, wanting to share that story. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, what's a moving picture worth? These days, with the phenomenon of police shootings, sometimes video footage is the only thing strong enough to hold someone accountable. The next best thing might be a witness or a testimonial, but personal accounts are famously unreliable. Sometimes it's all we have. Documentaries are a filmmaker's way to show rather than tell in trying to present a truth. Sometimes the truths they're after are dark. Sometimes they're downright scary. Sometimes they might qualify as horror. So we did a little experiment in trying to candidly interview each other for some added content for this episode. We each wrote questions for the other person to be read by someone else without the other person being there.
Right.
Someone who didn't already know the answers to the questions. The results, we're hoping, gives a little insight into the two of us and the podcast.
Right.
It was a silly question thinking back to it, because there's only one subject that we consistently talk about, and that's scary movies. So from there, I started looking around to other podcasts on horror movies and sort of figured that there wasn't really a regular, like, intellectual take on horror movies that had the kind of production that I love, something like a Radiolab or even This American Life. And so I kind of wanted to do that, to sort of do the academic approach to appreciating horror movies and sort of loving them and talking the great ones up and sort of pointing out where the bad ones went wrong. And, you know, we will make jokes in the process.
We're going to start off with 2009's Cropsey. Written as much as you can write a documentary, by Joshua Zeman, and directed by Joshua Zeman and Barbara Brancaccio.
And there is, I guess it's more spontaneous because it's sort of on camera, but there is, in terms of writing, there is quite a bit of editorial material in there. But yeah, we'll get into it a little bit deeper. But this couple also did the Urban Legends documentary that's on Netflix streaming, which frankly wasn't as good. It was pretty heavy-handed. It was like a television production, kind of overdoing it with music cues, and
I didn't watch it.
It also kind of fizzled out towards the end. The like killer clown segment was
terrible,
kind of baseless.
Oh.
But in any case, Cropsey is their best work so far. The name is kind of, I think it's specific to like East Coast,
yes,
urban legend boogeyman stories. And for like straight up horror nerds, Cropsey might be familiar as the character name in The Burning that we covered in our summer camp horror.
Right.
And also the movie Madman was originally supposed to use
Be Cropsey.
Name Cropsey.
But there were so many Cropseys that summer. I mean, so many movies featuring a Cropsey-like character. Yeah, everyone had to kind of move it around so they wouldn't all step on each other's Cropsey toes. It's actually, origins come from Boy Scout camp, and it's a camp kind of a story.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and it is an East Coast thing. in the documentary, you hear a little bit from a guy who's a professor of folklore.
Yeah.
And he explains kind of the origin of it. And then you can actually go online and there's other folklore about Cropsey that you can find. And it seems to be a Boy Scout kind of originated thing.
Okay. It makes sense. It's the kind of stories that get told around a campfire.
Of course.
Growing up on Staten Island, Barbara and I had often heard the legend of Cropsey. For the kids in our neighborhood, Cropsey was the escaped mental patient who lived in the tunnels beneath the old abandoned Willowbrook Mental Institution, who would come out late at night, snatch children off the streets. Although we didn't know each other as children, Barbara and I had both shared versions of the Cropsey legend as it filtered through our separate neighborhoods and seeped into our collective fears. Sometimes Cropsey had a hook for a hand. Other times he wielded a bloody axe. But it didn't matter. Cropsey was out there, lurking in the shadows, waiting to get us.
In the 70s and 80s, kids going missing, kids kidnapped. Adam Walsh went missing at that time. Some kids' uncle sabotaged their Halloween candy, and so parents everywhere were terrified. Cropsey was kind of the name given to the boogeyman.
Right.
Every urban legend, from the hook-handed villain and cautionary teenage stories to the child abductor, Cropsey was all over New York, New Jersey, and in this case, Staten Island. In the documentary, they talk about how Staten Island was quite remote up to the 60s when the Verrazano Bridge was built.
Right, right. Which I didn't know all that, like, until I had watched Cropsey. I knew it was a garbage heap, but yeah, I thought it was like a figurative.
It was
a landfill. I thought it was like a figurative thing that people said, but not literal.
Yeah, I had an uncle who lived on Staten Island, so my memory of Staten Island was the smell and an above ground pool.
I've been to Staten Island two times.
For a wedding, right?
Yeah, for a wedding. Yeah. And that was it. And I probably won't go back. It's very far away.
Yeah, I mean, it's so residential. And, I mean, that stands in contrast from its origin, that it's actually got a lot of natural woods.
Right.
And in those woods is the Willowbrook Mental Institution, which these days is, you know, sort of a fallen apart, abandoned mental institution, kind of the thing of haunted house stories.
Right, right.
But it first came to light in 1972 when Geraldo kind of...
It is the best thing that Geraldo Rivera has probably ever done.
Back in 1972, the Willowbrook State School was the subject of a famous expose by a young reporter looking for his big break.
I first heard of this big place with the pretty sounding name because of a call I received from a member of the Willowbrook staff, a Dr. Michael Wilkins. The doctor invited me to see the conditions he was talking about, so unannounced and unexpected by the school administration, we toured building number 6. The doctor had warned me that it would be bad. It was horrible. There was one attendant for perhaps 50 severely and profoundly retarded children. Lying on the floor, naked and smeared with their own feces, they were making a pitiful sound, a kind of mournful wail that it's impossible for me to forget. This is what it looked like. This is what it sounded like. But how can I tell you about the way it smelled? It smelled of filth, it smelled of disease, and it smelled of death.
So there's this documentary on Willowbrook State School, and it's called Unforgotten, 25 Years After Willowbrook, and it talks to some of the people who were housed there.
Okay.
And it's heartbreaking, and it makes you sick to your stomach, and you can't believe that in the United States, this is what we did.
Yeah.
And this is how many years after Bedlam in England.
Yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah. What's really sad is there were people with like MS and stuff and even something like spina bifida, where it's not a mental disorder. And these people were just put away to just be there. And these people were completely cognitively aware of what was going on. One man in particular who had cerebral palsy is interviewed in that documentary, and that's a horror show of a documentary. There was nothing wrong with him except for he has cerebral palsy. So mentally, you know, he just can't express what he wants to say. And he now is a lawyer for I think, civil rights kind of stuff. And he said he would wait. His parents left him there, and visiting day was Sunday. And he said he would wait. He was there from the time he was like a little kid to a high school age.
Wow.
And he would wait every Sunday and look out the window to see if his parents would come. Yeah. And it's a heartbreaking movie, heartbreaking story. So after you're done with Cropsey, that's a one to definitely check out.
Yeah, if you want to be bummed out. we get a glimpse, even in the Geraldo Rivera segment. It's not, you know, it's a couple minutes worth of footage, but mm-hmm. it really is the worst imaginable scene where these people with special needs are completely neglected. Yes. There are very few orderlies. Everyone is filthy. There are a number of naked people. No one is being looked after. Certainly
the
no one is getting help.
The lights are off, too.
The lights are off. They're in the dark. Mm-hmm. It was... So the documentary explains that even after that expose, it took another like 9 years for the state to actually start closing it down and penalizing these people. But that's all in the background. That just kind of serves to the Staten Island lore where right. in the woods is this hospital. In this hospital, some dark things are going down. So one of the employees of the Willowbrook Hospital was Andre Rand, who becomes this documentary's villain.
Mm-hmm. Andre Rand kind of comes to life or comes to light in this situation because Jennifer Schweiger in 1987 goes missing. She's a 12-year-old girl with Down syndrome, nuclear kind of family, everything's normal. And she's the first person that comes missing that makes everyone start to look at Andre Rand. What you discover as you go down the line and you follow the film is that she's not the first kid that's connected with him.
Right. Well, a lot of the quote-unquote detective work seemed like a little bit of a long shot. In terms of connecting all these cases, mm-hmm. it was a pretty broad stretch of time. And supposing that they were all taken by the same person, I thought was a little bit of a reach.
Yeah. To me, because you know how I am about the, and I love cold case documentaries, and I love, mm-hmm. you know, seeing stuff like this. To me, if a different person had made this documentary, you could have made this documentary about a witch hunt guy. This is a guy who worked as an orderly there, had some unsavory friends for sure. It was kind of friendly with a lot of pedophiles, a lot of criminal elements. He lived in the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, he is, you know, when I always say when these kind of documentaries come up that railroad some of these people, and I say, well, it's not bad things happening to good people. It's bad things happening to people who are kind of on the edges of good versus bad. And Andre Rand's definitely that. He's not a good guy that got railroaded, but he's not entirely clearly to blame.
Right. There's no, like, hard and fast evidence mm-hmm. that implicates him. And because the documentary seemingly talks to every citizen of Staten Island, we get a number of sort of conflicting opinions. Mm-hmm. Some people say he was a mastermind. Some people say he was incompetent. He was a devil worshiper. Everybody's got an opinion. And that I
and the rumors get out of control because Staten Island is a series very similar to New York, but actually more friendly to the rest of New York. Is that it's like all these tiny neighborhoods and everyone knows yeah. everyone's business. And you get the sense that in the mid to late 80s or throughout the entire 80s in Staten Island, it was a community where everyone knew everyone's business.
Yeah. And you know what? It was upon the second view. And the first time I watched it, I was thrilled. I was engaged. Mm-hmm. It was very creepy. The second time I watched it, I kind of picked up on there are some notes of desperation in a lot of the people who are seemingly like eager to tell their story, their relationship mm-hmm. with this guy, what they know or what they heard. It's so many variations of people wanting to be involved in this story that it starts to make you question like some of this might be completely invented.
Always involved in these things because I was so afraid to leave them. The whole Rand thing. Suppose he got out on a technicality. Would he come after me? You know, that's always in the back of my mind till this day.
Well, the idea of Rand, basically, when he is convicted of kidnapping, he never gets convicted of murdering the 12-year-old girl, but he's convicted on eyewitness testimony only.
Yeah.
And that's a fact. Eyewitness testimony only. Now, we all know now today how shitty eyewitness testimony is.
Yeah.
I would certainly never give eyewitness testimony myself because I know that it's so wrong.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I would only trust my memory if I wrote down what I saw immediately after seeing something.
You know what? I'll tell you, when I did get mugged,
yeah,
they asked me, you know, what did he look like? Could you pick him out of a lineup? And I said, no,
right.
I couldn't, because I know how wrong it is to rely on your eyewitness testimony. So that's what convicts this guy, Rand. And he's in prison for 17 years. Then the story goes on. The directors go on to kind of explore some of the other kids that go missing on Staten Island.
Yeah.
And you find out they are all actually connected through this guy. So, like, the guy worked as a janitor at one of the first girls that gets kidnapped and killed or missing.
Okay.
He worked as a janitor at that housing project. He knows the kid, the boy, the only boy,
the
Hank.
The older one, yeah.
Yeah, he's 21 years old, but he has severe
developmental disabilities.
Yeah, exactly. And what this guy does, Rand, except for one child, really kind of picks on kids with mental disabilities.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're assuming he did it.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah.
But what the documentaries led you to believe is that this is a guy going off, picking off kids that are really easy.
Yeah.
Makes. He does get convicted in the 80s of taking a bunch of kids on a school bus and taking them to the airport. That's
wild.
True. He serves a couple months in prison for rounding up some neighborhood kids in a school bus and taking them all over the place.
Yeesh. Yeah. And the filmmakers established communication with him in prison. And it's funny, for as much as you want to get like an evenly told story and get his side of things, the filmmakers try.
He makes it very difficult.
He's very cagey about details. He, you know, will, the only thing he's firm about is that the truth will come out. It's like, well, it's not gonna if you don't start talking.
Right, right.
And yeah, I don't know. It seems like there might be, he might have been working on a book that sort of explained his side.
Right.
But I think ultimately I got the sense that he enjoys the attention,
mm-hmm.
but he's not a mastermind. He's
no.
not a particularly bright guy. He's, you know, just kind of figuring things out. He's very concerned about his reputation in prison.
Yes.
And so he doesn't want to make things worse for himself and be known as a child murderer, because
we
all know in prison, those guys don't last very long.
Right. What you also find is kind of a mystery, and they barely touch on it, and I don't know if you caught it. It's that kind of quick. Is that the police comb these grounds at first. This is back to the Jennifer Schweiger in 1987. They're looking everywhere. The police are looking with dogs and everything. And they go past this plot of land. They don't notice anything. A couple days later is when the volunteer people come in.
Find her.
And they find her very easily.
Yeah.
Very, very easily. Also, you find out that she was placed in a different way than she actually died. So that's kind of another interesting thing about, gee, it was really easy for them. When a group of people easily find something that the police didn't find,
yeah,
it makes me think, I don't know, like a Nightmare on Elm Street kind of parents kind of thing.
Okay. My mind went to the Haman Lee in the Serial series, how her body was, I mean, as randomly as could be, found in a you know, sort of clearing off the side of the road.
Right.
Yeah.
And this was actually really similar, because don't they see her feet first, Haman Lee? I feel like the guy, when he goes out into the woods, this one, they find the kid's toes, which the toes are the first thing they find. That's the topmost thing. And when this girl was murdered, though, the toes had all the blood in it. So you know that it was toes down.
Wow.
And okay. Kept toes down for a while is kind of the implication of that.
The detectives who worked the case originally star in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And for better or worse, they just kind of seem like average fellows. They're not particularly sharp. They didn't have any really solid insight to the case.
Right.
They had missed entirely that one of the kids who went missing appeared on a nightly news piece for Jennifer,
and
who went missing.
That particular kid, that's the boy, the only boy in it. And he's really identifiable because he looks like Mick Jagger. You know, so like you missed that. You missed that that's the kid.
Yeah, so the documentary shows the cops watching this footage and they're like, huh, how do you like that?
Yeah. Huh, neat. Like, okay. Oh,
we're all seeing this for the first time. Well done.
Know that Andre Rand is still alive. He is in prison in New York. He was up for parole. He was supposed to be up for parole for the first Jennifer Schweiger because it was only kidnapping. 17 years is what he got for that. But then about a couple years before he was up for being done with that sentence,
he was charged again.
He was charged again for Holly Ann Hughes, which is one of the first ones. That's in 1981. He was charged for her.
And was that the one that the girl who testified to having seen him take the girl, she was interviewed outside the courthouse?
You knew Holly Ann?
Yeah, I knew a bunch of them that he had kidnapped. Did you know Hank Aforia?
You know Hank Aforia?
That one I didn't know. I knew Letitia.
Jackie. Yeah. All these people you knew growing up on Staten Island, they all were disappearing. What did you think?
I didn't think anything because I was too young. And now that I am older, I came here to do what I gotta do, and I feel a whole lot better now.
She, even in the small, she's on camera for maybe like 3 minutes and she tells her story differently.
She reeks of someone who is desperately wanting to be involved, loves the attention of the process, and like even connected herself to the other victims.
Yeah.
Like,
she's a nutbag.
She's not on camera all that long, but it just screams that, like, I made all this up.
Yeah. Oh, you can. I mean, anyone with a brain, I can't imagine that a jury would sit there and, like, say, oh, you know what? That girl, she knows what's going on.
That's the irony that Andre Rand's lawyers actually struck me as competent.
They were competent, but let me tell you something, and I don't, it's a dangerous kind of thing to say. The brother of Holly Ann Hughes is like a lieutenant. Okay. In the NYPD.
Okay.
And he is the one who really brought this case forward. So if someone wants to find witnesses or anything like that, there's boots on the ground to find them.
Mm.
So he did, I'm sure, a very thorough job in finding people.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It ultimately, it's open-ended because there weren't any, like, nail-in-the-coffin type convictions.
No. Basically, he's in prison. He's going to be eligible for parole in 2037, and he'll be 93 years old at that time.
Hello, Marshall with England. This is Andre Rand. I want to know if you received my letter. It's been about 2 weeks now. You haven't answered me yet.
So of the six documentary styles, we kind of figured that Cropsey fits under the participatory documentaries style, which... Participatory documentaries believe that it's impossible for the act of filmmaking to not influence or alter the effects being filmed. What these films do emulate, the approach of the anthropologist, participant observation. Not only is the filmmaker part of the film, we also get a sense of how situations in the film are affected or altered by her presence. That's weird that it assumes it's a woman.
I could have also a strong feeling for the expository documentary because... it's promoting a strong point of view. I think it's promoting a pretty strong point of view that this Andre Rand is the guy and is trying to persuade the viewer. So I would kind of say that could also be part of it.
Is there anything about the show that scares you?
That scares me? About the show? I mean, I get, when we do a big topic, I guess I get scared of thinking about all the research and the notes that I have to write, because I don't always write that many notes. I think it's probably why Darren gets, he probably gets irritated by that. But so just the preparation of a show is always daunting. Every time we do a new large show, it's not that it's scary, it's that it's daunting to get all your facts straight. And also, I think, like, I always am really trying to make sure everything is factually correct, like dates and things like that, because, you know, I would say, and maybe I'm putting this on it, but I would say that as a lady in horror, like the moment you say, you know, Hexon was from 1929, people are going to be like, it was 1922 and you're an idiot. So, you know, you have to really, I think, I have to really get my facts really, really crisp and clean. And so it's not scary, it's just daunting, I would say.
In terms of styles, our next one is an observational documentary.
Definitely.
And that one's The Galapagos Affair, Satan Came to Eden.
Yeah.
From 2013, and you brought this to my attention a long time ago.
Yeah, because it was one of those gems, you know. I go on these documentary binges on Netflix, and this was one of those that I found, and I loved it. It's directed by Daniel Geller and Dana Goldfein. It takes place in the Galapagos, on specifically the island of Floriana.
When I think of the Galapagos, I figure, like, protected habitat where, like, mankind is not welcome. Like, there are some rare species that would only flourish without mankind to sort of affect.
Right, right.
But back then, it was just thought of as Eden waiting to be plundered, it seems.
Waited to be ruined.
But, so the story follows three different families, the first of which was Friedrich Ritter, a German guy who considered himself something of a Nietzsche.
He considered himself to be fanatic. A lot of things.
Dora and I are turning our backs on civilization. We have mapped out a plan to permanently migrate to an uninhabited spot on the Earth's surface. The Galapagos.
His love interest, was she his wife?
I don't think. No. Here's the deal with Friedrich and Dora. Dora comes over with him because she was married to another person.
Oh, and right.
Friedrich was also married to another person. And this is not good in Germany. And they actually leave kind of Berlin, yes, to go discover this new place, but also because Friedrich had to get the fuck out of Berlin. It was not good.
He was a weird guy. So him and Dora, who thought of him as like a mentor.
She was like, yeah, really into his thoughts.
And we know this because they journaled like no one's documented before. They, without like having a radio on hand before televisions were common, they had a lot of downtime and they spent it journaling.
Yeah.
And so the documentary really terrifically casts all these people and has people like Cate Blanchett, Diane Kruger, Connie Nielsen, all these people are reading these pieces in the appropriate accents.
Right.
And really doing it up. So the production, I think, with the exception of the actors reading the not letters, but journals, we've got some testimonials, but otherwise there isn't a narrative voice that kind of tells you step by step.
No.
It's just the source material telling the story.
It's coming from these people.
They took a tremendous amount of photographs. Mm-hmm. And I mean, shockingly, they also had like an 8mm camera on hand. And so there's tons of video footage of the Galapagos from the 20s.
Yeah.
The tortoise plays a big part.
I remember when you watched it and you said, that tortoise is really sinister. What are they trying to tell me with that
there
tortoise?
There were times where they played. All right. Well, I guess there is music. There is accompanying music to the documentary because it's conspicuous when they have a shot of the tortoise with ominous music playing. And it's like, that fucking turtle is up to something.
It's him all along. Everything that went wrong was because of that turtle.
Dice que las tortugas en Galápagos ya han desarrollado una captación de la mentalidad de la gente que pasa.
So Frederick and Dora are the first ones to go there. They pick the island with the least of any human remnants.
Yep.
The other islands might have some shacks. That's way too much. They don't. Right. They want to start from scratch. And they do so. And before long, another couple show up. And they're like, me too, right, guys? Us too? Let's...
But, like, Friedrich is a real asshole always.
Yeah, he wanted to be alone. And
obviously.
Then people start showing up on the shore. And he's like, no thanks, no thanks.
Go away.
Yeah.
I do not know why it is that certain events cast ominous shadows long before they come about. But so it was with me before the Witmers came. The weather was perfect, the garden growing well, and yet something within me refused to be quieted. Then, one morning, far out at sea, we saw a schooner which seemed to be approaching Black Beach.
So the second family that shows up are the Whitmers.
Yeah.
And they don't... They have even less of a plan than Friedrich, it
yeah,
seems.
It's a husband and a wife and a child, a boy. And the wife is pregnant when she shows up. Because best thing to do when you're pregnant is go to an island with two other people on it.
Yeah.
That don't like, want you there.
It's
also,
like
they're not your family.
Opting into Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. So they show up there. And yeah, they do have probably even less business than the Ritters, because the Ritters don't have a lot either. They're very bad at most everything.
Yeah.
You find like through other people's letters, you find out that kind of the Ritters did some of the things that they did, and people called them nudists, but they weren't nudists. It was just like really hot. And so that's why they did it. And so you find out certain things that drew kind of them to do weird, what we would say is weird things, was out of necessity because they didn't have the skills. They lived under a tin roof because they didn't have the skills to build a house.
Oh, yeah. My impression was that Friedrich kind of was good at the naturalist stuff.
Yeah.
But it turns out they actually received a lot of stuff from passing ships.
Right. Which becomes
odds
then
and ends and supplies.
The fighting later on with our third group, our third family who
the
joins
Baroness.
The party. The Baroness Eloise von Wagner-Bosquet.
Which
and
sounds regal, but it turns
does.
Out she was full of shit.
She was definitely full of shit. She was married to a guy in France, the Bosquet. That's that part, Bosquet. That man's mother-in-law hated her so much that the mother-in-law set her up with Robert Philipson and Rudolph Lorenz.
Figuring one of them will take her.
So she takes
off her hands.
Both of them. The Baroness takes both of them, and off they go now to the Galapagos under this guise of kind of going to build a hotel there. And they're actually partially funded by the Ecuadorian government at the time because of this promise of this hotel that's never going
to
be.
She talked a good game. And let's be specific, she is the Satan they're referring to in terms of coming to Eden. The two guys that she's arrived with. There are implications that this is a love triangle. She
kind
of
treats the three of them are together.
Treats one well, that would be Robert, and treats Rudolph like garbage.
Total garbage. They beat him up. They beat each other, though. They're like very volatile group of people here.
Rudolph is always looking for an out, it seems, and he winds up with the Whitmers more than a couple times. But
he's the couch that you go sleep on.
But the Baroness literally shows up at the gate, like screaming after him and demanding that he come back. Which, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess company was slim pickings on the island, but he eventually had enough.
Yeah.
So as the families fall apart and everything's kind of exacerbated, if there's a particularly hot season, they lose their garden, the animals start dying, and things
Ritter
start looking
a dick.
Grim.
Whitmers are actually kind of doing really well because the man even builds a house. Like,
yeah. And their kids, I mean, it's weird to think that their lineage actually, some of them stayed on the island.
Yeah.
Some of them finally got around to that dream of the hotel.
Yeah. Yeah. And they run that tourism group there. But the third group, what becomes the biggest, I think, point of animosity is that the Ritters had been taking handouts from yachts and boats that are coming by the Galapagos. And that's why they were, how they were eating a lot of times, how they were sustaining themselves. But the Baroness becomes so popular that I think Ritter, in number one, he's jealous of the food and things like that that she's getting, but also he's just jealous of the attention.
You think it was that? I got the feeling that like, He wanted to be alone, and every person on that island was a nuisance.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I was reading and if you watch this documentary and you want to know more about it, on the Smithsonian. On the Smithsonian Institution archives online, there's all these extra letters.
Yeah, you were telling me that there's actually way more to the story than was sort of fine-tuned for the Galapagos affair. There were other characters. There were people coming in and out.
Right.
But these are the three families that they chose to stick with and tell the story of.
Right.
Well, it's the most compelling.
You really hear a lot from the Whitmer family kind of after the conclusion of this. So around 1936, you really mm-hmm. start to hear kind of what their opinion of these things was.
Right.
And part of their kind of idea was that he was very jealous.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So while it probably wasn't jealousy so much as just like reaching his breaking point, Rudolph tells a pretty strange story of how people have chosen to leave the island out of the blue.
Suddenly, Rudolph runs over the Whitmers and says, oh, the people I've been living here with for those last times and we're, you know, all this family together.
You know those people I hated? They're gone.
They're leaving, and they said I could have all their things.
Yeah, and he's also willing to sell them the remaining contents.
Because I don't really want to stay here now.
Yeah, and so everybody is pretty sure that that Rudolph dispatched with Robert and the Baroness. And, you know, further evidence to that is he's in a big goddamn hurry to get off that island.
Yeah, he wants to leave. But interesting, like, a yacht does come, and it's not, I don't think, in the movie, but a yacht does come, but he doesn't take it for some reason, and you don't really know why he doesn't go on that first yacht out. And I would be curious maybe to see kind of why, if there was police on the boat, something like that.
Yeah, it seemed like a much smaller boat that he finally did go off with.
Yeah, and he wants to leave immediately. So he goes off with this, I think it's a Swedish guy who's the captain of a boat, and the weather's bad and everything's terrible. The boat's kind of a piece of shit, and the captain says, well, you should probably wait, and he says, no, I gotta go now. We gotta go right now. And he convinces that guy to take him. That boat fails. The engines fail. It's terrible, choppy, choppy waters. They get out on a little tiny rowboat safety boat thing, and that's where they're found.
Yeah, there is footage of the time. And again, I mentioned this is 8mm film that they happen to have and even shoot and get developed. And we get to see the mummified bodies that, I mean, I've only seen the special effects.
The sea, like, really preserves you.
Yeah, I guess that's salt water because they were right there on the shore.
Yeah.
But Rudolph is not there.
Yeah.
And again, he's gone. There's bodies. Yeah, it was really well done. It was very eerie. Seeing a legit mummified corpse, I wasn't expecting that.
No, there's also a movie within this movie. In 1934, the Baroness decides to make a movie because she's so flattered by a captain who came over on one of the yachts. He says, I want to make this movie, and she can't say no because she's such an egomaniac.
Yeah, she loves the attention.
So they do this pirate movie. It's a short film. You kind of see her boobs.
Yeah, you can see through her shirt.
Yeah. She maybe is not, like, attractive in the face, but that's okay. She never let that stop her.
She's one of six women on an island. Wait, no. She's one of three women on an island.
Yes.
Yeah, so she kind of had her druthers. This story kind of goes down as one of those truth is stranger than fiction type affairs between, like, the completely bizarre setting of the Galapagos Islands, the idea that there are children alive today who were born on the island, who grew up in that setting, and sort of interviews with some of the people from Ecuador who knew the sort of passing ships and relationships that the people on the island had with those around them. I don't know. It was all pretty, pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I love this one just because it's just facts, or it's just these people speaking from this time that doesn't exist now. You know, there's no.
Yeah. Did place it make you want to like keep that. A journal? I kind of.
No.
I like the idea of an account. I want like a daily.
I don't want people to know some of the things I'm doing. They'll be like, what an idiot she was.
You should, like, definitely start keeping a dream journal, but we'll get around to that.
Yeah, she's like, this girl only watches horror movies and she goes spinning. This is the only things this person does.
It doesn't even sound like you're on a bike. It just sounds like you go out to the street and you spin
and
in circles.
Spin around in circles.
What is my favorite thing that we've encountered so far? I will say I am consistently surprised, happily so, to reach back, you know, very early on, we challenged ourselves with the Universal Monsters series. And so these films that go back to 1931, you kind of watch nervously as a horror fan because they are canon. These are the pillars on which the genre was born. And if you don't think they're great, then, you know, everybody in the horror community looks at you like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and, you know, treats you like a, you know, the outsider. But that said, most of those movies hold up really well. I mean, you and I watched The Wolfman, and that is not a good film, but it's brethren, and even some of the follow-ups aren't bad. It's just that one stinks on ice. But so even, say, going back to, like, Mario Bava's stuff, the Hammer monsters, all of these movies kind of, like, tickle your enthusiasm to chase down more, and my curiosities are now sort of woken up to, hey, what am I missing? Because I there was a big hole in my sort of sense of horror, and yeah, I don't know, anything that sort of raised my curiosity is a huge payoff. So yeah, going back and digging up stuff is great.
So these next few we're going to move through because they're not firmly in what I would say is the horror genre.
Right.
But they certainly have some creepy elements to them. So 1992's Brother's Keeper. This was directed by Joe Berliner and Bruce Sanofsky. And
which you would know, well, I mean, I would know, and I hope lots of people know, because if you haven't, stop what you're doing right now, pause this, we'll wait. Go watch Paradise Lost, because they're who brought kind of, no, not kind of, they are who brought the West Memphis Three out to the open.
I didn't realize that. Wow. Yeah. Okay. And they did all three parts of that?
They did. They did the Paradise Lost ones. They, you yeah. know, there's other films now, but right, the Paradise right. Lost were these guys.
So this film is about an alleged murder in 1990 in the village of Munnsville, New York. Now, I wouldn't have guessed it was New York if it didn't come up a couple of times, but it's funny. I'm having lived here, I think of New York, I think of New York City, but right. this is rural. This is like almost Appalachian seeming.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were simple people. And the documentary is brutally fucking honest in its portrayal of these guys who, I think, with the exception of a couple questions and prompts, the filmmakers are never really noticeable as part of this documentary.
Right.
So this is far more of an observational documentary in attempting to simply spontaneously capture moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I don't go deep with documentary styles, but I think of something like Grey Gardens is one of those where mm-hmm. it's just pieces of these people's lives. If they feel like talking, they talk.
Right.
If not, you're just there in the atmosphere.
Right, right. I think this is one of those movies that, you know, I because I watch so many of this cold case kind of stuff or people convicted of not maybe the right thing. This is one of those that turns into, you're really seeing these characters and they seem very two-dimensional because they seem like these Appalachian kind of backwoods kind of guys.
Yeah, simple.
But there's a lot going on and there's a lot with the town.
Joe Berlinger, take one.
These guys were considered the village idiots. You know, the town didn't want anything to do with them. They were like the smelly old guys up on the hill who never married and live in squalor. But the moment the state police came in and kind of coerced a confession, or so the town believed, of murder, all of a sudden the town embraced them.
We're nonfiction filmmakers, we're verite filmmakers. Yes, we do interviews, but what we really prefer to do is to just let things happen as they happen. We were in the courtroom every day. We were at all the hearings. We were at fundraisers, and we were in neighbors' houses just filming them at a dinner. I mean, that's the beauty of documentary film, is you get to see through a window other ways of living. And these people were amazing.
Some of the characters in the town are, again, like, these aren't characters you could really write in fiction because you might not believe it. I mean, there were I mean, just the language spoken and the sort of rural dialect, I needed subtitles for a lot of it.
Sometimes it is hard to hear. And I mean, I didn't grow up in a place quite like that, but I grew up in a farm community.
Mm-hmm.
And not only a farm community, but where there was actually a lot of Quakers in our area. And a lot of time Quakers won't really have power. They'll have a well, stuff like that, but they're just not into that, and that's fine. And they do their own thing, and you know what? Like, if you can have a Quaker as a neighbor, it's the best thing ever because they're going to stick to themselves. They're going to always do something nice because they have to.
They're great at woodworking.
Exactly.
You need your couch fixed.
They put chairs on the walls. I never quite understood why chairs go on the walls, but they do. And so this kind of, I think maybe I liked it so much because it reminded me of growing up, and it reminded me so much. There's a scene where they go into the auction barn.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I would go with my grandpa on Saturday mornings, really early. You'd go to the auction barn. And so to me, it's a very extreme view of what I had growing up or what I, saw.
Yeah. So and concentrated.
So you had these kind of social outcasts in this town, but when push comes to shove, that town rallied around those brothers like you wouldn't imagine.
Yeah.
Writing $1,000 checks like it's nothing. And that's amazing. They came up with the bail in 20 minutes for this brother.
When we were down in the courthouse, we went down just to look. Didn't have any idea what we were getting into. And when they posted to it, the judge said that he would let him out on $10,000 bail. And we went down. I went down. She sat in a seat up there, and I went down where the lawyer was explaining it to us. Of course, we're a bunch of dummies, you know. We didn't understand the procedure. And the lawyer said, we got to scrape up $10,000. So I went back to where she sat. I said, Mom, I said, you got your checkbook with you? And she says, yes. And I said, Jesus Christ, make out a check for $1,000. She says, what for? And I says, they're doing a lot of talking on it. They got to scrape up $10,000, and nobody, they're doing a lot of ifing and anding, but no money. So I took down the check and handed it to Charlie. I said, Charlie, here's a start for the $10,000. And touched the ball off. Yeah, we had $10,000 inside of 10, 15 minutes. Yeah, it wouldn't hurt anymore than my kid. Because
you wouldn't believe
we knew that. The kid, you know, we've known him all our life.
He isn't a kid, but he's younger than you.
Well, Christ, he's 60 years old, number 80. Hell of a lot of
time. After they got his whiskers off, he looked younger.
It's kind of a non sequitur, but it bears mention. The old couple that are on camera for, they're interviewed, it seems like a couple of parts are chopped up, but they talk over each other. Like, there is no, I mean, talk about being
naturalistic. They remind me of my great-grandparents.
Yeah?
Because at one point, too, he calls her mother.
Yeah.
And, like, my great-grandparents used to do that. And it's just like, I don't know. I love those two old people.
Yeah. They're just, like, one more representation of, like, this is the older generation, but they are through and through that town.
Right.
So while this documentary isn't really horror, it does play with some creepy elements, and it kind of, similar to Cropsey, it does kind of go back to the idea of like testimonials and whose opinion can you really trust, whose motives might be involved and what they're delivering to the camera. But ultimately you do get like a real deep sense of this like small community of, you know, simple but strong people. One of the characters actually does point out that from an outsider's perspective, we might seem very simple, but I'll be damned if anybody actually does as much work as these guys do. These guys are farmers through and through. And so the like technical skill and ability that requires will go unnoticed to your outside casual observer.
Right. I mean, I think constantly people have an idea that simple equals, you know, stupid.
Right.
And whilst these brothers seem to be developmentally disabled in certain ways.
Yeah.
Simple doesn't mean stupid, though. Simple is not complicated. And I think people think simple and think, oh, that's like some, you know, dummy from the middle of nowhere. But really, you have to think that simple really means uncomplicated and give these people a little bit more credit, you know?
Okay. Okay, one that we'll run through because in terms of genre, it's not really horror, but no. I'm
horrified by it.
I have a little bit of a sensitivity. We're talking about 2006's Jesus Camp.
This is a sick old world.
Kids, you gotta change things.
Boys and girls can change the world? Absolutely.
I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag.
There are two kinds of people in the world. People who love Jesus and people who don't.
Speak the word of the Lord!
Where should we be putting our focus? I'll tell you where our enemies are putting it. They're putting it on the kids.
How long have you been a Christian?
At 5, I got saved.
Yeah?
Because I just wanted more of life.
You go into Palestine, and they're taking their kids to camps like we take our kids to Bible camps, and they're putting hand grenades in their hands.
I got Jesus. Yes, I do. I got Jesus. How about you?
There's an excitement, yet there's a peace with it all, too. It's really cool.
I really feel that we're a key generation to Jesus coming back. And we are a generation that needs to rise up and run with that baton.
Yeah. How many of you want to be those who would give up their lives for Jesus?
We're being trained to be God's army.
Got it now!
You are the beginnings of a movement. Raise up righteous judges!
There's a new church like this every 2 days in America.
25% of the American population, that's about 80 million people.
If the evangelicals vote, they determine the election.
They've taken over the White House, Congress, the judiciary for a generation.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Are you a part of it or not?
It is an inside look at a Christian day camp that is run by kind of a tyrant, a pretty frightening woman.
Yeah.
Someone who talks about like raising the soldiers of Christ.
Yeah.
And she talks, I mean, she makes the parallel herself that there are jihadists at this very moment raising children to be suicide bombers and to fight the world on that end. And so, it is our duty, to make Christian warriors. And yeah, a recurring thought was that like this documentary, maybe a change of location and maybe they're not speaking English, but maybe they're speaking Arabic or Farsi even. Yeah, this would be unsettling because it is a like dogmatic obsession that, I mean, traumatizes some of these kids on camera.
Absolutely.
There are like horrifying moments just, you know, just in like what we'll call an education of children, but like it goes deep.
Yeah, it's a disturbing film. Definitely, you know, when I say what's horror and what's not horror, I mean, there's definitely horrific elements in this. This is one of those movies that I probably got like 10 minutes in and I was like broken down crying because I grew up also in the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And so it was very close to home for me because it's really disturbing what's being done to these kids and what's being passed on and what these kids are being forced to value, things like that. And it's very different than my life. So,
yeah.
And I just can't understand it because it's very different than my life and my values and things like that. And so I see it as an outsider and say, holy crap, this is scary, right?
Yeah. The sort of repeating thought is that like, if it left me unsettled and kind of jarred, then in my mind, I kind of categorize it under horror.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of other people would, but that one stays with me. Although those kids did get to ride in gas-powered go-karts.
Which seems pretty cool.
Frankly, I'll believe whatever you want me to believe if I get to ride go-karts.
So I want to race around.
That was the only redeeming thing about this camp. Otherwise, it's just a lot of guilt on 8-year-olds.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff then that comes to light later because this is in 2006, probably filmed mostly in 2005. But you find out Ted Haggerty, who gets in trouble maybe just the next year.
Yeah,
in
the news. Is it Haggard? I think it's Haggard.
Oh, sorry.
But yeah, he was the like mega pastor. Who
right,
was
and he makes a cameo.
Yeah, Yeah, he inspires a couple kids.
Yeah.
And then he went off and, you know, smoked some meth and banged some hookers. But, yeah. You know, it's all fine. Just don't be a hypocrite.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's cool. Because, you know, God will forgive you for doing whatever you're doing.
All things. Just
rent
ask.
Boys, meth, whatever.
So one that we've already covered is actually Hexon from 1922. And that came up in our Scandinavian episode where... Yeah. Scandahar, that's where you're supposed
Scandahor.
To
say. Hashtag Scandahor.
So Hexon, at the time it was made, was like hugely ahead of its time. And the point of the documentary is to sort of show the ridiculous accusations that took place during the times of the Inquisitions. And the idea that people were tortured, they were punished. Mm-hmm. It was just like these horrible atrocities were done in the name of devil worship.
Right.
They were trying to weed out surprising amount of like misogyny and like nun breakdown.
Yeah.
In that documentary.
But it kind of like is like, you people are really stupid for believing that this was the devil. It was really because women are crazy. So that's kind of the whole point of that 1922 film. It's just like, you're so dumb. It's just because women are hysterical.
For more on Hexon, check out our Scandahar episode. That was
and
from
check it
2 months
out.
Back.
You
three
can
months.
Get it on YouTube, I think, is where you can actually see it.
While we're doing these sort of non sequiturs, I'll also mention that Aaron Mankey's podcast, Lore, it's been blowing up, and now they announced that it's going to be a show on AMC. His documentary plays with the idea of truth being stranger than fiction. So while it's not a documentary series, the way Karina Longworth's podcast, You Must Remember This, is, Aaron Mankey does a really great job of assembling these human accounts of eerie, sometimes supernatural phenomenon. So check that one out. That's Aaron Mankey's Lore.
What you guys are into right now, what do you think is the next big thing for horror?
I think what you're seeing, and I mean what we're seeing, is a real kind of, not like a crossover, but a sort of sublimating of genres into horror. I think people are testing the waters in horror and saying, this community is great, this is something I would like to be a part of. So you're finding, I think, a lot more thrillers that are calling themselves horror, which is going back to my point of like trying to be more open-minded about what is horror, because I think that's evolving in a way that no one had seen. I think you're also going to see a great next step with Oculus, with different virtual reality kind of things. There's some amazing games that are up on Kickstarter to support, and they're really scary. I mean, what's better than it's the next step of, you know, when you used to, Resident Evil 1 was so scary, you know, at the time, and something like Silent Hill, but holy shit, what if you're in Silent Hill, you know? And I think that's really going to be a great next future.
The last documentary that is totally worth mentioning is The Nightmare from 2015, directed by Rodney Asher. This one, to me, I didn't know what to expect. You picked this movie, and I didn't really know what to expect.
Oh, I thought you had already seen it.
No, okay. I'd never seen it. This was like an amazing, eye-opening adventure for me.
Asher was behind the documentary Room 237, and he also did a segment on the ABCs of Death Part 2, mm-hmm. but Room 237 gets a lot of criticism for playing fast and loose with the documentary format. And I'll say The Nightmare is even more subjective, but you kind of have to appreciate it for what it is, which is a completely based on personal accounts assembly of the idea of sleep paralysis.
Right.
And
this
what
is
follows.
Definitely like textbook performatory documentary.
Yeah.
My girlfriend at the time and I, we were talking about just different paranormal stories, and she started telling me about how sometimes she would wake up in the middle of the night just like unable to move or breathe, and she said it felt like there's like an evil presence in the room with her, and that it would just like kind of like torment her, and then she would eventually wake up and it'd be like it was just a dream. And after she told me that, I didn't really know what to make of it. I was like, okay, I got involved with some crazy girl, and I just kind of changed the subject, started talking about something else. And then about a week later, I laid down to go to sleep. Just as I started to drift off, I felt my body just become extremely heavy. And it was like I fell asleep, but then woke up at like the same instant. And just my whole body started tingling. It felt like really weighted down, like something was pulling me. And I heard this like sound. It wasn't like outside of my head, but it was just like inside of my head. It just sounded like a wash machine. Just kind of like out of balance or something, just like banging against the wall.
You know, because you're getting these people's firsthand account. There's seven different people from mostly the States, one person in Manchester.
Yeah, they did some traveling for this.
Yeah.
I wonder what the process of having people apply to tell their story was, because these people were clearly selected and curated.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the main theme is the idea of sleep paralysis.
Yeah, which had you been familiar with before the documentary?
Yeah, I'd heard about sleep paralysis because, you know, I've heard about a lot of different things because I have night terrors like I do. So you go and you look and you say, does someone have this, this, and this?
Okay, I happen to know this because you've told me in the past, but describe what it means to have night terrors.
Well, there's lots of different, you know, there's different kinds of night terrors. So a lot of people would say, oh, you know, when you wake up screaming in the middle of the night, that's night terror. If you have chronic nightmares, that's night terrors. What I have, which I actually found there's a name for it, because I didn't think about looking until I actually saw this movie and saying, like, do other people do this? I don't know. But what I have is hypnagogic hallucinations.
Oh.
So that's like where you're going to sleep or you're waking up from sleep and your brain is still sleeping. Like your brain is still in a dream state, but you're awake as well. So it's like thinking almost two things at once.
So are you overlapping sort of dream with reality? We're going to talk about shadow people in a minute.
Yeah. No. So what it feels like to me is that I'm awake and I'm aware, but things that maybe I was dreaming about, I take as gospel truth and I believe it.
Oh.
So and usually it comes
from... So it's like false memories.
Yeah. And so usually it comes like following a nightmare. Because I have it more when I wake up, not when I go to sleep, but when I am coming out of a dream. And so this nightmare, whatever you were fighting in the nightmare, seems completely plausible to be right where I am right then. And I believe it 100%. You know what I'm saying? It's like that's the terror I have. And I don't have sleep paralysis, but I have this apparently a terrible fight or flight response, which is neither one of those things. I just get really still. And try and like imagine that the ghost will go away if I can't see. It's like I'm fighting a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Right. That's what I do. And what's horrible is a lot of time I'm so worked up and I'm like sweaty, but I'm under the covers and so you can't move. So you just sit there and sweat your ass off. That's my life.
I was familiar with sleep paralysis, I think, after an episode of Radiolab. So it was kind of in the back of my head. And the concept is fascinating because it clearly has been documented in different forms, like, you know, however many hundreds, if not thousands of years, you go back to the concept of like an incubus or a succubus.
Absolutely.
Or these sort of classical painting images of this creature pressing down on someone's chest. And people have done the scientific research and sort of figured out what's happening. But ultimately, it's something it's inexplicable to the novice. And I thought it was all fascinating. It was resting there in the back of my head. And so by now it's probably like closer to 8 years ago. I was doing stand-up comedy. So it was a lot of late nights and it was a very late, very drunk night. And then I woke up late for work to the alarm and couldn't move. And for, you know, what probably amounted to like a minute and a half, I had just
forever.
The tornado of thoughts whizzing through my head, where I was first thinking like, holy shit, this is sleep paralysis. I've read about this. I can't move my hand. Wait, no. I'm drunk. I'm still drunk. I woke up drunk and slow, delayed. So I was fine.
You didn't have sleep paralysis. You were just drunk. That was a drunken stupor is what you were in.
Yeah. So that's my relationship to it all. I mean, these days I sleep like a baby. But yeah, so for balance, I would have liked a little more consideration for the common hallucinations and the auditory hallucinations mm-hmm. that come with that condition. It does seem a little old-fashioned to dwell on the idea of ghosts or shadow people rather than address any of it actually scientifically.
Yeah, this definitely doesn't come from a scientific point of view.
Yeah.
It actually like kind of, what is that, languishes in or kind of surrounds itself yeah. in the supernatural aspect of this.
Yeah, so the documentary illustrates a number of these people's experiences. So mm-hmm. sometimes as they're narrating what they go through, we get the visual representation of that. And so those are the moments that are unsettling. And even just from like a storytelling point of view, when these people are relaying nightmares, they're scary.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
effectively scary.
The reenactments are awesome, actually. I yeah. think that's what really makes this film. And it's very tense, and the reenactments are excellent based on what they're telling the whoever's doing the artwork for it. I loved it.
I began hearing voices and screams and crying and all of this really emotional drama, yelling to crying, but all negative emotion, all of these different voices. And then that is when the shadow man would come toward me. He looked just like a three-dimensional shadow, outline, just perfect. And he would walk, disjointed. And he brought the vibration with him. It's as if it was emanating from him. And he would come towards me, and I would just feel that here. I would hear all the sounds of hell, I don't know any other way to put it, and feel his awful vibration. And I would have a fight-flight response. And I would completely, you know, freak out and try to scream or get away. And many times the intensity just continued.
So you're introduced to all of these characters, and they tell a basic kind of idea of when they started having this, what goes on. And what you start to realize is these people have the same experience. These people are, one guy is across the ocean. These people are all over the United States, and they're having such similar experiences. The idea of shadow men, I thought that was just something that happened to me. And I had never really heard of anyone else having that or experiencing that until I watched that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's me. And they were describing the way it looked, and they even did the reenactments, which were awesome on the film. And I was just like, that's me. I'd never heard that.
Wow. Okay.
You know, and a lot of times sleep disorders run in the family. So my father has a same sleep disorder like myself, and my great grandmother did too.
Okay.
So I don't know. It's something to me, it was always a normal thing because this was in my family kind of thing, but to see someone else on TV experience it, not just someone else, seven other people basically experiencing this, it was like, oh, that's really cool. Okay.
So I've got some details on REM behavioral disorder. And so Mike Birbiglia, for those who know, Mike Birbiglia is a comic, and he's described his condition in the movie Sleepwalk With Me and also his stand-up material. It's almost the opposite of sleep paralysis, but it could explain certain people's seeming out-of-body experiences.
Right, right.
So typically during REM sleep, your eyes are moving relative to what you're seeing in your dreams, but your body is relaxed and still. If a person has REM behavior disorder, their body doesn't paralyze. It does not relax and disconnect from your brain as you dream. So people literally act out their dreams, which can be terrifying when you consider that people mm-hmm. have hurt or even at times killed their partners sleeping next to them. And none of this is taking into account people tripping balls on Ambien.
Right. Well, and that's something I kind of was curious about. These people, we're not discussing what sleeping drugs they might be taking or
yeah,
if any or
so
other drugs they might be taking,
untouched,
which you can kind of
yeah.
assume on one of those people that there might be some drugs going on.
So that's REM behavior disorder, but sleep paralysis happens when the components of REM paralysis are still at play, but the person has gained consciousness. In a study done on rats, they found the neurotransmitters GABA and glycine cause REM sleep paralysis by switching off the specialized cells in the brain that allow muscles to be active. This is an excerpt from an article on brainpickings.org that focused on the book The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery by Sam Keen. Deep inside the reptile brain sits the pons, a hump in the brainstem an inch long. When we fall asleep, the pons initiates dreaming by sending signals through the mammal brain to the primate brain, where dreams stir to life. During dreams, the pons also dispatches a message to the spinal cord beneath it, which produces chemicals to make your muscles flaccid. This temporary paralysis prevents you from acting out nightmares by fleeing the bedroom or taking swings at werewolves. Earlier today, we were talking about the process, and a number of things came to light, particularly your routine to sort of get in the controlled state of sleep.
Yeah, because when these kind of things like happen to you, this kind of terror, you'd never want it to happen again, because it's like real. You think this is all real, and even there's hardly anything until you start to kind of wake up a little bit from it. You think this is real at this particular point in time.
Oh, yeah.
So I have like a routine, and you were laughing about it, but to me it's normal because I've been doing it since probably like 7 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I always, if I have, obviously my husband is with me, but if I'm away on business and I'm in a hotel,
this was the best.
Then I leave all the lights on, because what you get when you turn off some of the lights or any kind of lights, and maybe there's some light from the outside, then you can see the shadow people. So it's really to avoid seeing like shadow people. So I leave all the lights on. All the lights are bright on.
And you can't have a nightlight on.
No, because, again, it's to avoid shadows. I really do almost everything I can do to avoid a shadow, because then I'm going to interpret that shadow as Shadow Man.
Wait, so that's the lights on. You wouldn't prefer to have all the lights off without anything?
No, because a little bit of light will come through the window, and then I'm going to see shadows again.
Okay.
And there's also...
Silly for me to ask.
There's a woman who actually, in the nightmare, she's one of the people being interviewed, and she actually describes a tapping on the window sound that she heard, and she thinks it's real. I mean, a lot of the people in this documentary are not taking it as like, this is a scientific thing that happens because of the following things.
Sure, in terms of experience, like you were saying, this is a real moment. Their state, it doesn't occur to them that like, I am half asleep right now. It is just like, holy shit, there's someone in the room with me.
Right.
And these hallucinations aren't just visual hallucinations, but auditory hallucinations.
Absolutely.
As well.
Because I've had the tapping on the window and laughing before.
Oh,
and
God.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying, you know? So
does it affect your ability to take naps?
No, I can take naps because it's daylight, and you know, also I think I have an assumption in my brain for some reason that says scary shit only happens at dark time.
Oh, fair enough.
So then when I'm by myself, I leave all the lights on, but I also make a barrier of pillows, and I'll ask for extra pillows. I'll call and get more pillows if there's just not enough.
They're like, room 214 is building a fort.
And so I put a barrier on both sides of the bed, so I sleep in the middle of the barrier.
Mm.
And that's to avoid like waking up. My greatest sleeping fear is waking up with my face by the side of or the edge of the mattress and having something be in my face.
Okay, since the time you were 7.
Yeah, this is constantly like my fear. I sleep with my hands.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm big. It's extreme.
Until I started describing it to you, I can see how like it probably seems weird, but to me, it's like a normal, it's just a thing. And
right,
so,
it's routine, yeah.
Yeah, and so it doesn't even stand out as like, oh, I'm going to do this because of this and this and this. I just the following
thing.
Yeah,
it's just, it's sleep prep.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. And so I always sleep, I put my bed always against a wall. Shut up.
Murphy wants attention.
Okay.
So I put my bed always against a wall so that I can sleep by the wall, because again,
so
avoiding.
So nothing sneaking up on you.
Exactly. I'm always avoiding the edge of the bed.
And you've got issues with anything that might be under the bed. Although that doesn't seem sleep related. That's just
no, that's
afraid
just
of
a
things
terror
under the bed.
Thing. Yeah, that's just a separate terror thing.
It's like the long-term repercussions of being a horror movie fan.
Exactly. Yeah. Mostly it's just to avoid shadows, because if you get in this, and I probably haven't had this happen in maybe like 6-8 months, Okay. Where, you know, you're waking up, but you think this is legitimately real.
You should get that. It's been a while. The whiteboard. Been like these many days since an incident.
Then it'll probably make it happen, because that was another thing they talk about in the nightmare. Like, as soon as they start thinking about it, then they
it brings it on.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny, when you were describing it, it occurred to me some of the characters interviewed in the movie, just shy of desperate, their behavior is kind of one of like being nervous around sleep. And mm-hmm. I'm kind of, I feel a tremendous amount of empathy for someone who might have like PTSD from sure. their own recurring nightmares. It's a pretty extreme scenario. Actually, that reminds me, the documentary does use quite a bit of footage from Nightmare on Elm Street, the very mm-hmm. first one, Wes Craven. And incidentally, the Women in Caskets have done a multi-part series of the Nightmare franchise.
Anything you want to know about Nightmare, those girls are doing it.
They went deep with production details and behind-the-scenes facts. Check them out, Women in Caskets out of Austin. But I think that's it for this one, Nightmare. It's a good watch. I wouldn't watch it overly eager to criticize the documentary style. It is kind of playing fast and loose.
I think you should definitely, it's really for a person who wants to kind of indulge a supernatural idea because it'll scare the shit out of you. If you view it from a not scientific, but rather a supernatural point of view, it's scary as shit.
Yeah.
That was Murphy. He's helping us record.
So that's it for this episode on documentary horror. As per usual, we are on all social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Rance Macabre. You can email us at therancemacabre@gmail.com. And that is also our website is therancemacabre.com, where we have regular updates and bonus content, including my album that is out there. It's available on Fangoria's website and iTunes and Spotify. What else? Am I missing anything?
We're on Google Play. We're on Stitcher. We're on iTunes.
We are on all those things. Find us. Drop us a review. Help us out. Let's spread the podcast. You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario, that's me, and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Handley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.